But as I have stated many times, to have an astronomer comment on a close encounter UFO case is as interesting as having an ornithologist comment on nuclear physics. The only person whose view is of value is the field investigator who has done a thorough and critical study and documentation of the case. Being a critic is not enough. You must have knowledge and empirical data. 3. 14 events makes them unappealing to the scientific community because they present an enormous challenge to established theories. It has to do with that almost universally expressed human frailty, the closed mind. It is the blind refusal to even consider any alleged fact or event or theory that conflicts with a predetermined viewpoint. Durant mentioned that many scientists who joined situ insisted on anonymity. As a scientist to openly advocate the serious study of UFO, 14 and paranormal phenomena within academia is to be a heretic. You have then entered the domain of forbidden science as presented by Jacques Vallée and stand all the chances of becoming the Giordano Bruno of your cultural epoch. Another article that has some relation to Durant's discussion is paranormal phenomena, should psychology really go beyond the ontological debate? By Jean Michelle Brassett, published in Journal of Exceptional Experiences and Psychology Volume 1, 2013. Since it could be detrimental to the academic career to clearly state a belief in the authenticity of paranormal phenomena, many psychologists stand safely aside from the ontological debate. Brassett advocates more bravery or transparency among researchers. I advocate that psychologists studying alleged paranormal phenomena should at least be able to state what their own beliefs are on the topic they are studying. If we can imagine that a committed Christian can legitimately study personal prayer, why not a medium studying mediumship? When it comes to the serious study of UFO, 14 and paranormal phenomena, we clearly need heretical scientists, a pathfinder force of daring and iconoclastic scholars not trapped in the flatland paradigm of a materialist and reductionist worldview. An interesting letter. In the extensive collection of books donated to AFU by Hilary Evans, I found a first edition, 1903, of The Other Side of Death by Theosophist Charles Leadbeater. A comprehensive study of various types of paranormal phenomena. To my surprise, there was also an original letter by Charles Leadbeater, written on January 6, 1909, put between the pages and probably forgotten by the recipient. The letter proved to be of special significance from a ufological perspective as it concerns the possibility of a medium visiting other planets. Mr. Leadbeater writes, "You may take it that it is quite impossible that your mediums should have visited other planets, though no doubt they quite honestly they think they did. Any non-human entities engaged would probably be nature, spirits." The comment by Leadbeater is interesting as it was written 60 years before Jacques Vallée's classic Passport to Magonia. From folklore to flying saucers. What Leadbeater is trying to explain is that nature, spirits have the ability to deceive human beings into observing illusionary scenes and playing various other tricks on the mind. John Keel, with his theory of the deceptive ultra-terrestrials, is probably smiling in his heaven if he happened to read this. In the first book from the pen of Charles Leadbeater, The Astral Plane, 1895, he has this to say: "And then these entities, their forms are many and various, but most frequently human in shape and somewhat diminutive in size. Like almost all inhabitants of the astral plane, they are able to assume any appearance at will. Under ordinary conditions they are not visible to physical sight at all, but they have the power of making themselves so by materialization when they wish to be seen. In most cases when they come into contact with man they either show indifference or dislike, or else take an impish delight in deceiving him and playing childish tricks upon him." The nature, spirit explanation appears reasonable in the cases I mentioned in an earlier blog entry. But could this theory also be applied to another somewhat more complicated contact case? The percipient Jorge Z. was born in Honduras, 47 years old with a wife and four kids. On January 20, 2008 Jorge Z. is traveling in his car a few miles east of Natal, north of Stockholm. Suddenly a bright light appears over the road and the wooded area. The light is a combination of yellow, white and blue and is moving quickly. Hawkeye assumes it could be a chopper. Suddenly there is a voice in his head ordering him to keep on driving. The voice is very clear, "Move to the left, continue." After a couple of miles Hawkeye enter a place called Nuttelgvikan and he parks the car. Standing beside the car he can hear a sound like a generator. Looking up he observes a saucer-shaped, silver-colored object with a light in the middle. Hawkeye becomes very frightened and says to himself, "A flying saucer. That's not possible. God help me." A light appears at the bottom of the object, shining down on the ground. In this beam an entity is floating down and start approaching the car. The entity makes a halt about 8-10 meters from Hawkeye and the beam is retracted into the object. Hawkeye tries to run but he is paralyzed. The entity approaches and Hawkeye notices its large dark, oblique eyes. It is not more than 140-150 centimeter with a large head and long, skinny arms with four fingers. No nose, only two small holes and no ears. The entity is completely naked, hairless and lacking genitals. Hawkeye compared the feet to that of a duck. "Don't be afraid, I will not hurt you," says the entity and put his hand on Hawkeye's shoulder. The hand feels exceptionally hard. A short conversation ensues. "Miguel, my god, who are you? A god or an angel?" "Entity, we are neither gods nor angels. My name is Horez and I come from Reticulum 4, a planet very far from Earth. A long time ago you were chosen for this contact. Some of your ancestors were in contact with us and now is the time to bring a message to humanity. You can't reach all the world but many people. There are already people who have been prepared to help you and with their help you will deliver the message." Hawkeye asks if he can touch the entity. Horace says yes and Hawkeye touches his arm which is warm and feels like hard flesh without a skeleton. After about 20 minutes Hawkeye is ordered to come back the next day at 3 p.m. The object appears again and the entity is lifted up in the beam. The object disappears very quick, like turning of a light. When Hawkeye arrives at home he is very upset and find it difficult to sleep. On January 21 he returned to the same spot. This time an object comes up out of the water in Nuttelgvikan. Three entities leave the object to meet Hawkeye. Besides Horrors there is now Zeros and Andrak. They want to help Earth humanity and claim there soon will be an open contact. Hawkeye is requested to contact church leaders to explain that they are here. After a rather long conversation the three entities board the object again and it disappears in the water. Second contact. Hawkeye contacts UFO, Sweden and on February 3, 2008 I make a short interview on the phone. He is nervous, upset and don't know how to handle the situation. Later I receive a short written report and drawings of his experiences. We communicate a few times by phone and mail and suddenly I receive the last email saying that he has left for the United States. After this, I have not been able to trace Hawkeye. So what do you have here, given the story is genuine? Cosmic jokers, deceiving nature, spirits, elementals, biological robots created by a superior technology, alien visitors? Hawkeye appeared sincere but confused and he was very glad I took the time to listen to what he had to say. Unfortunately I never had a chance to follow up the case and visit him for a thorough documentation. Maybe he is now spreading the message of Horrors somewhere in the world. The change comes from space. Whatever the nature and origin of UFOs the phenomenon has made a deep impact on our culture, both from a sociological and psychological viewpoint. There has been a military response to the sightings, a scientific response and a neo-religious response from various New Age groups. But perhaps most visible to the public has been the establishing of a new sub-culture of societies, the global community of UFO organizations, with books, magazines and conventions. There are now many scholarly studies of the UFO movement and biographies of well-known ufologists. But, to my knowledge, very few studies have been made regarding the psychological effects of close encounter experiences. Basically, Does the UFO observation result in any permanent change in outlook on life or behavior of the witnesses? During my many years as field investigator, I have met with a wide variety of witness response to close encounters. For many witnesses, the experience has been transformative in the sense that it engendered new interests and social contacts. Such was the case with Peggy Robert. 1936-2010, a Swedish woman I interviewed in Norrköping on September 1, 1984. She later took the surname Medani. On a chilly September evening in 1973, Peggy is traveling by car to meet a friend living in Kilafors, in the province of Hälsingland. Between the municipalities Gisinge and Sandviken, she noticed a bright blinking light on the left side of the road. Peggy's first thought is that this may be a helicopter. The light follows the car, and not far from the small locality Arsunda, she gets a closer look at the light, and now an object appear in clear view. It has the classic saucer shape with windows around the brim, from which comes a yellow light. The object is of a silver-gray color. The UFO followed gently over the houses in towards the community. I didn't dare to continue the trip into the forest again, but stopped to see what would happen. Peggy parks her car close to a house and decides to alert the people living nearby, but change her mind as it is very late, close to midnight. She studies the object for about 20 minutes sitting in her car with the window open. There is no sound as the object is oscillating and bobbing up and down, very close, at treetop level. Peggy estimates the diameter to about 10 meters. Underneath is a blue-white light shining down like a spotlight. In the yellow light from the windows, Peggy notices entities moving back and forth. She can't see them clearly, only the upper of the entities and in silhouette. I must confess that I felt very solemn and peaceful. I was entirely exalted and happy. After some 20 minutes, Peggy decides to continue the journey and the object disappears behind the forest. But not far from Sandviken, close to Lake Stjärnan, the object is visible once again and now makes a turn just a few meters above the car and then fly away over the lake. When Peggy arrives at Kilafors, she is totally exhausted. She just wants to sleep. When I got into bed, it felt like an arrow of force in my body, going from the feet, up the spine and to the head. There it circulated, and at the same time my body felt like a big lump of dough floating out over the bed. It was an unpleasant experience. Suddenly the arrow of force turned and went down the spine again and out from the feet. After this had happened, Peggy fell asleep. This UFO observation became a turning point in the life of Peggy Robert. Before this happened, she described herself as a typical ego-tripping materialist, basically interested in expensive clothes, jewelry, cars and the good life. Now I knew there was something else in other dimensions, life that is different and more evolved. After this contact with the UFO, I couldn't accept Christianity as presented in the churches. Now I started an intensive period of searching. Peggy contacted many alternative religious and spiritual groups. She went to India to meet the Indian guru Sai Baba and for a time found inner peace with his teachings. Back in Sweden, she studied alternative medicine, reflexology, acupressure and nutrition. After this, she started working at various health resorts helping people with both physical and psychological problems. Peggy Robert obviously had good talents for both physical and spiritual healing, and she became quite well known and appreciated among colleagues and clients. In a biographical article in the large daily Norrköpings Tidningar, June 15, 1985, she was described as a philosopher and health prophet interested in the mysteries of the universe. During her last years, she worked at Wettershus Resort, owned by the Mission Covenant Church of Sweden. After her death in November 10, 2010, a pastor at the church described Peggy in obituary as an open-minded searcher who combined wisdom from spiritual teachers from all over the world. She doesn't look like a member of the church, but if anyone has love, it's Peggy. So what actually happened to Peggy Robert on that cold September night in 1973? A crisis vision? Misinterpretation of an ordinary object? Or was their interaction with an unknown craft resulting in both profound physiological and psychological effects? Peggy was convinced that highly developed beings from other planets was responsible for her experience. Many times during my interview she reiterated the change comes from space. We are given a helping hand but it is up to us what we do with this help. Whatever happened to Peggy, the UFO experience made her a loving idealist, philosopher and a friend and comforter for many. For the student of the esoteric tradition, the sentence "the change comes from space" has a special significance. In several of the books written by Alice Bailey, as amanuensis for the Tibetan, there are many almost prophetic statements regarding the coming intervention of interplanetary beings. These statements were received before the beginning of the UFO era in 1947. So far as I am aware, no ufologist or scholar of esotericism has associated these quotes with the large increase of UFO sightings after 1946-47. Especially in Bailey's The Externalization of the Hierarchy, there is much discussion whether the planetary guardians, adepts or custodians of the ancient wisdom will succeed in receive help from interplanetary sources in the crisis period 1933-1945. Here are a few relevant quotes, 1981 edition: "Thus will the work of the hierarchy be facilitated and the door open to the regenerative forces of those extraplanetary beings who offer their help at this time and particularly during 1936 inches, p. 25, April 1935, "Hovering today within the aura of our planet are certain great spiritual forces and entities, awaiting the opportunity to participate actively to the work of world redemption, re-adjustment and reconstruction." P. 222, April, May 1940, "The waiting extra-planetary forces can make their work possible and effective." P. 223, April, May 1940, "Certain great energies of extra-planetary significance who stand ready to intervene should the spiritual invocation or the distress of humanity reach the pitch of evocation." P. 392, April 1943, "That contact has now been established as a result of the inflow of certain extra-planetary forces." P. 525, January 1946. These are only a few quotes from the many Alice Bailey volumes that speak of a coming contact and intervention from interplanetary beings. Whether these quotes have any connection to the UFO phenomenon can only be a speculation. But maybe Peggy Robert had a point when she told me, "Don't forget, the change comes from space." Leprechauns, humanoids and dark plasma. Late one evening in January 1931, 24 years old farmhand Helge Eriksson had an experience that he would never forget. He worked on a farmstead called Dunnebo, not far from Islöv, in the Swedish province of Skåne. It is a clear and beautiful winter evening when he decides to visit a friend on a farm nearby. They meet for a couple of hours and then Helge starts his way home around 10 p.m. Not far from Dunnebo, he is confronted by a very unusual sight. In 1973, my FU colleague, Anders Liljegren, did a telephone interview with Helge and received the following narrative: "I was close to the farmhouse where I worked when I noticed 10, 12 very small men approaching. They were at a distance of around 50 meters when I discovered them and they came in my direction at a fast pace. They were so small, they reached only to my knees, and I remember this strange sight frightened me. The men pass by Helge only a few meters away and in the bright moonlight he gets a good view of their appearance and dress. The small entities are wearing dark green clothes with caps. To Helge their dress appear to be made in one piece. All the men wear a beard but their heads are unusually large compared to their bodies. Facial expression is hard and cruel. From the group comes a strong smell which was felt a long time afterwards. The men seem to be conscious of Helge's presence but they take no notice of him passing by, walking in an almost military fashion on the frozen ground. The sound of their footsteps is clearly heard and the troop continue out on a nearby field. Looking out on the field, Helge observes a strange, blue-violet light, hidden in some sort of fog. The light is so intense that he has never seen anything like it. Suddenly there is a whining sound in the air and the whole sight is gone. Helge explains to Anders Lodgren that he has wondered a lot about this meeting and also told some friends of what happened. Some believe him, others doubt his story. "I met them myself, I heard the footsteps, saw their eyes and faces, felt the smell. I have never experienced anything like this since, and when it happened I was fully conscious. These were no ordinary people I met, they must have been from another world." Helge Eriksson interviewed Ines Karlstuna, Dreiren, December 27, 1977. After Anders Lodgren's interview, Helge was contacted by several journalists and ufologists. He was obviously affected by the then prevalent view that this must be space people. Extraterrestrial visitors was the usual interpretation for these type of sightings far into the 1970s. This is very noticeable in a letter written by Helge Eriksson to UFO Sweden some time later. Probably he had been convinced of this theory by the ufologists who contacted him. He writes in this letter, "In January 1931 I had a strange meeting with space people whom I both heard and observed. My first thought was that this must be people from another planet. This is obviously a rationalization. It is highly unlikely that a young farmhand in 1930s Sweden would associate such an experience with space people. There is no mention of extraterrestrial visitors in Anders Lodgren's interview nor in the first narrative written by Helge in the Swedish magazine Saxons Veckotidning 1974. In his second book Besöker från Kosmos, Visitors from Cosmos, Swedish ufologist Mr. Boris Ljungqvist comments on this case in typical E.T. fashion. "Everything indicates that he has witnessed a classic UFO landing. Maybe this was the first UFO landing case and observation of humanoids in modern times in Sweden." Boris Ljungqvist was a fervent exponent of the ETI hypothesis, heavily influenced by the grand old man of Swedish ufology, APRO representative Mr. K. Gosteren. He was the Kehoe of Sweden, advocating the extraterrestrial theory in his four books in the 1960s and 70s. As a hardline atheist and the materialist, Wren regarded the theories of John Keel and Jacques Vallée as a terrible blind alley. He fought furiously against anything that could be regarded as occultism in ufology. The ETI theory was the only scientifically acceptable. Anyone reading the narrative of Helge Eriksson and somewhat acquainted with folklore must notice the similarities to the many stories of leprechauns. This was what Jacques Vallée discovered in the 1960s, which resulted in his classic Passport to Magonia, 1969. To exponents of the psychosocial theory, Helge's experience is an example of a culturally determined vision or hallucination. But Vallée was also a student of the Hermetic and esoteric traditions, and his interpretation went in another direction. "I believe that the UFO phenomenon represents evidence for other dimensions beyond space-time. The UFOs may not come from ordinary space, but from a multiverse which is all around us, and of which we have stubbornly refused to consider the disturbing reality in spite of the evidence available to us for centuries. Such a theory is required in order to explain both the modern cases and the chronicles of Magonia, the abductions and the psychic component. On the internet, I recently found an interesting variation of the multiverse theory proposed by J. Alfred, an independent researcher and consultant to Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies team. He is also research director of Dark Plasma Life Research Organization." J. Alfred writes, "Dark plasma theory explains a wide variety of phenomena associated with genuine sightings of aliens, ghosts, deities, jinns and angels by both individuals and groups, using an internally consistent scientific framework. These sightings betray the presence of plasma-based life forms originating from a counterpart sister Earth gravitationally coupled to the visible Earth. The dark plasma theory is basically the esoteric tradition teachings presented in a different terminology. It has much in common with theosophist Charles Leadbeater's taxonomy of the inhabitants of the multiverse, human, non-human and artificial, presented in his classic The Astral Plane, 1895. Like Helge Eriksson, we stand a good chance, according to Leadbeater, of encountering a wide variety of entities, not all pleasant. I come to think of the suggestive last paragraph of John Keel's Strange Creatures from Time and Space, belief, or disbelief, will come to you from another direction. Next week, next month, or next year you may be driving along a deserted country road late at night and as you round a bend you will suddenly see owls and UFOs. For many years I have been collecting owl figurines of various types and material. I became fascinated by these unusual birds symbolizing both wisdom, magic and mysticism, and my collection now comprises something like 60 plus owls. But it was not until the last couple of years that I became aware of the connection between UFO sightings and owls. There are now several internet sites dedicated to investigating and documenting this connection. According to tradition, owls are associated with shape shifting. In the UFO clippings archive I found a very unusual humanoid report possibly involving this phenomenon. It was printed in the Swedish daily Smålandsposten, August 8, 1987, and the observation occurred in the summer of 1980, not far from Blomstermalla in the Swedish province Småland. The headline has the spectacular claim, "I saw the devil." In the late summer of 1980, Swedish, American Ingvar Oskar Jonsson from Chicago is on holiday in Sweden. This evening he is traveling by car from the eastern coast to Åsida. In the back seat his 11-year-old son is sleeping. A beautiful moon is shining over the trees. Not far from Blomstermalla the sky is suddenly lighted up with a blue light and a large owl appears in front of the car. Ingvar can hear its cry as the owl lands on the windscreen. The face of the owl appears very human and this scares Ingvar as he feels like the owl is looking at him. After a few moments it lifts and disappears. After traveling a couple of miles Ingvar has his next experience with the unknown. Not far from Kragsmala he notices what he first believes is an animal coming up from the side of the road. This creature is floating up in the air in front of the car. Ingvar can't see its face but it is covered with brown hair, has two legs, a tail, two horns and long ears. The creature floats just above the car and Ingvar is afraid it's been hit so he stops and takes a look around but find no trace of whatever he saw. The rest of the journey is quiet. After this event Ingvar has talked to relatives and friends in Småland but no one has experienced anything like this. In the UFO Sweden report archive I found another observation involving an owl and UFO. In the summer of 1966 two young men are traveling by moped to Sorbo in the Swedish province Dalarna. Time is around 22 p.m. They take a short break to pee and then discover ears an owl sitting on a post beside the road. But looking up they also notice something else. A large silver-colored craft hanging in the sky about 150 meters above the ground. They don't mention the shape of the craft but it is surrounded by a strange light. The craft moves slowly across the nearby fields and now and then emits flashes of light. The boys decides to follow the craft and soon observe it landing in a field. When on the ground it appears to be surrounded by some sort of fog. Light is coming from what could be windows and the boys notice movements by what appears to be figures in the fog and light. When the boys try to get a closer look the craft leaves the ground and accelerates with very high speed, at the same time producing flashes of light. This just a sample of Swedish cases involving owls and UFOs. There are probably several more in the archive. I know of one more case but the connection between the owls and UFO is not so clear in this observation. A deeper study in the Swedish folklore archives on owls could probably yield more data. Humanoids, aliens, elementals. In the May, June 2013 issue of OVNI, Journal of the Phenomenon Research Association, Margaret Fry tells of an extraordinary paranormal experience she had in 1970. Margaret Fry is a veteran investigator of UFO and paranormal phenomena and author of Who Are They? 2004, and Linked to the Stars, 2009. In the spring of 1970 she went to visit her pen, friend Francisco Julanda in Barcelona. During the night Margaret woke up to see moonlight streaming into the room through the patio windows. And there in the corner by a wash basin sat three little devils with horns. They formed a close circle and each had their heads bent, one arm linked and the other hand over their three quarters closed large eyes. Margaret yells, and as Francisco wake up, their beds are rolling violently all over the room. Petrified, she manages to jump to Francisco's bed. As the beds are zigzagging fast about the room, Francisco tries to reach the switch and put the lights on.